Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds podcast with Danny V.
Today I interview Lily Wilkinson. Lily is the author of 12 books, including Green Valentine, Pink, and The Boundless Sublime. Lily has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Melbourne and now spends most of her time reading and writing books for teenagers. Her latest novel and the novel we discussed today is After the Lights Go Out. 17-year-old Prue lives with her twin sisters Grace and Blythe and their father Rick on the outskirts of an isolated mining community. The Palmers are doomsday preppers. They have a bunker filled with non-perishable food and a year's worth of water. One day, while Rick is at the mine, the power goes out. It doesn't take long for everything to unravel. In town, supplies run out and people get desperate. The sisters decide to keep their bunker a secret. The world is different, the rules are different. Survival is everything, and family comes first. I hope you enjoy this interview with Lily Wilkinson. She will also be appearing at the Williamstown Literary Festival. Enjoy.
Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Lily. It's such a pleasure to chat to you about After the Lights Go Out. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you for having me.
I am intrigued, as I assume you are, by doomsday preppers. And yes. Our protagonist, Prudence, her twin sisters and their father are extreme doomsday preppers on a grand scale. How did this idea emerge for the novel?
A friend of me sent me an article just saying, like, I think this will be in your wheelhouse because I'd already written a book about cults. Mm-hmm. And it was an article about doomsday preppers. And it wasn't really something I knew a tremendous amount about. But I read this article and it specifically kind of went into this idea of the morality of prepping. The idea that preppers must keep all of their preps a secret because if you let everybody know, then they'll all come for your stuff when doomsday happens. And so then that idea of, like, are you okay with being the person who is fine and has meals and has food and while your next door neighbor's children are starving. And that idea was very, very kind of sparkly to me. It felt like something I really wanted to spend more time with. So I immediately, like after reading that article, sent my editor a text message saying, can I write a book about preppers? And she wrote back and said, yes, and off I went.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because I think the extreme behaviours of people is really interesting. But then, like you said, the secrecy is interesting. And on top of that, the morality comes into it, you know, and I found that interesting that you explored that in the book as well, because if something does happen, the old rules no longer apply anymore.
Yeah, and I'm really, really fascinated by, you know, the idea of like the grey areas. Like, I'm not particularly interested in sort of like a good versus evil narrative, because to me it always just feels very simplistic. And so I work best in those grey areas of, like, you know, is it the right thing to do? Is it not the right thing to do? And how do you decide, like in a real world situation, how do you decide what to do when the right decision is not clear?
The strongest only survive. And it's interesting because when I was thinking about this, it's the most vulnerable people that will struggle to survive in these dire circumstances. People with diabetes or anaphylactic allergies or just any condition that relies on medication just to survive. And I think it was really confronting to think of this because I think a lot of us kind of rely on modern medicine these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And like the very old and the very young, like, and yeah, it's a huge thing. We are so reliant on technology. And you're right, it is the people who are the most vulnerable who stand to lose the most. And usually those are not the people in charge. charge.
Yes, exactly.
And what do you do if it's your kid who has the allergy? And, you know, are you willing to, you know, potentially put your own kid's life on the line in order to do the right thing and make sure there's some for everyone?
Yeah.
You know, that's not a decision that most people would make very easily.
Absolutely, because especially when it comes to your children, I think most people would say they would do anything to, you know, ensure their survival. But then that's when you get into all those grey areas, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
Because I'm not sure many people know how to just whip up some insulin, you know, or whip up an EpiPen.
Nope. No, it's definitely not something that you could DIY, or at least I don't think it is. I didn't look into that. Maybe I should.
Maybe we can Google it. It actually brought something really to the forefront for me that I think the modern world, as wonderful as it is, like you say, we're so reliant on technology. And, you know, I've watched The Walking Dead and all those kind of disaster films, but I do wonder how long many of us would last if there was some kind of a disaster, and how many of us could be self-sufficient in a short period of time, because I was thinking how useful I would be, and not very.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, and like I have a veggie garden and I have three not particularly useful chickens, and you know, I can make a decent loaf of sourdough bread, but you know, that lasts me for a couple of weeks. And then what happens? You know, what happens when I run out of flour for my fancy sourdough bread? And so, and then like, I just read Neil Schusterman's Dry, which has a sort of a similar premise. Instead of there suddenly being no electricity, there's suddenly no water. And like, that's the other thing. Like, we are so reliant on water and sanitation, particularly in the big cities, like, we'd all just die.
Yeah, and that kind of modern technology, it makes life easy. It also makes us very vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it makes life easier up to a certain point until we suddenly don't have it anymore, and then not so much.
Dystopia, it's been very popular for a long time, and I love reading dystopian fiction. And, you know, this has a lot more to it as well, but there is certainly an element of dystopia to it. What do you think it is? What draws readers to it, do you think?
I think people have always been drawn to that kind of idea, but I think it's particularly popular at the moment, sort of because of our political climate. I think we are sort of becoming much more aware of the kind of the machinations of power, and I think that that makes people very uncomfortable. I think that people are becoming more aware that like so much power and so much money is concentrated in the hands of so few people, and that, as you know, as we were saying before, those are not the vulnerable people. Those are the people who have everything, and so they are not necessarily inclined to think of those who are more vulnerable. And so I think that dystopia, particularly for teenagers, is sort of like a real sort of a blueprint and a release of like, well, how do we do it? How do we break down the system and start over and make something that's better?
I like that, the breaking down of the system. It might be a way in to understand, you know, the politics, the totalitarian societies or the power. So it might be a way in.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I, this is a very pretentious moment, I wrote my PhD thesis on young adult fiction as being a pathway to activism in teenagers. And it definitely is that. It definitely provides teenagers with a space to think through some really, really complex ideas about power and hegemony and who has the power and who doesn't have the power and who has a voice and who is silenced. And, you know, teenagers don't get to have a voice. They don't get to vote, despite the fact that they, you know, attend schools that are funded by the government. They use public facilities more than any other group. They use, you know, libraries and schools and parks more than pretty much any other age group do. They pay taxes, they pay GST. If they are buying things, if they have a part-time job, they will have to pay tax on those things. So, you know, they are definitely very, very active members of society, but they don't have any kind of say in how that society operates. And I think that can be really frustrating. I know for me as a teenager, that was hugely frustrating to sort of be a part of the world but have no say in what shape that world takes.
What a great PhD.
That sounds
amazing. Because I always say that literature is going to change the world, and it really helps young people to explore ideas that they wouldn't have before. So what an amazing PhD. How did you come up with that?
I just really wanted to write. I'm a massive politics nerd. I love politics, even when I hate it. And I really wanted to write about politics in young adult fiction. And I look specifically at contemporary fiction because dystopia just felt too big and scary to tackle in the PhD. But I wanted to talk about contemporary fiction that has politics in it. And interestingly, when I wrote the PhD a few years ago, there was very, very little contemporary realism that featured sort of activism and politics. And in the last couple of years, that has just exploded, particularly out of the US. And I think that we could probably all guess why.
Yes, I think we can. And I think you're right because, you know, I'm a teacher by day and, you know, when we talk about important issues, teenagers often feel very powerless. They're like, oh, you know, we understand the refugee crisis and we understand all these other things, but what can I do about it? So I really like the thread of your idea of, you know, that activism and what you can actually do to make a difference. Because there's one thing to be aware, which is the first step, but how can we do better than that?
Found some really great examples about like the Harry Potter Alliance is a really great example, which is an online Harry Potter fan club that, you know, identifies the real world dark arts and then asks the question, what would Dumbledore do? And then does stuff. And so they raised, you know, millions of dollars for earthquake victims in Haiti, and they have sent hundreds of thousands of books to developing nations, and they raise money for wells and water supplies. They lobby to make all of the Harry Potter branded chocolate frogs made from free trade chocolate. Like, they're just these really amazing young people who love literature and are trying to make the world a better place.
That's absolutely incredible, especially with the Harry Potter thread. I love that.
I know.
That's so great. So which house are you in?
I'm definitely a Ravenclaw.
We always get on the Harry Potter track, and it's just so interesting how universal that series is, isn't it?
Yeah, I wrote a chapter of my thesis on that, of exactly why I think it's universal. And yeah, I think it's a really fascinating series.
Absolutely. Give us a little glimpse of why, of what you said about it being universal.
I think it's because, this is a bit controversial, I think it's because it's kind of an ideological mess. I think that ideologically speaking, Harry Potter is incredibly contradictory, like in the way that we are supposed to believe that, you know, that house elves are, you know, should be liberated, but should they? Because they kind of like being slaves. And then when two of them do get liberated, one of them dies and the other one becomes an alcoholic. So maybe we like slavery. And the way that we're supposed to believe that the mudbloods like Hermione are just as good at being witches and wizards as purebloods. But at the end of the book, in the epilogue, only wizards marry off to other wizards. Nobody marries a muggle. And also the idea that, like, there are no married women with jobs in the entire Harry Potter series except for Tonks, who, you know, doesn't do well out of that. And so there's sort of all of these sort of really conflicting sort of conservative and progressive ideologies. And I think because of that, no matter what your ideological standpoint is, you can find it in Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. Because there's a little bit of everything, something for everyone.
That's really, really interesting. I like that angle on it because, you know, as you read them, I'm reading them the second time to my son this time, and it's just interesting the different things you pick up. And I thought that about, you know, about slavery as well. I was like, oh, this is a bit of an interesting sort of area, you know, because it's only Hermione who believes that they're being mistreated and everyone else is like, no, that's fine. I was like, well, this is an interesting angle.
Yeah, it's really complicated. And the fact that she's also got this whole white feminism angle of, like, that she knows better than they do, that they're saying we don't want to be free and she thinks she knows better. And, like, it's a mess. It's a big, big old mess.
So we got sidetracked by Harry Potter, but I think it's forgivable. It's always forgivable.
It is. It's inevitable.
Absolutely. Now, I found it really interesting, back to your book, the study of characters, because we meet them before the lights go out, but then we follow them through this disaster that happens. And as a reader, we're able to track how each character responds to disaster. And I think it was also a really interesting psychological exploration. And it made me question, as we touched on before, how you would respond.
Yeah, it was really important to me to have a real kind of variety of responses. And I can, you know, I would like to think that I would be a good person and share my resources and, you know, privileged community over the individual if I were to be in that situation. But I just don't know. I don't think we can ever know unless we're there. I feel like it's that kind of pressure would make us all do things that we perhaps wouldn't necessarily be proud of. And I think that was one of the ideas that I really, really wanted to explore in the book, was what do you do afterwards? And originally I had planned for halfway through the book for all of the lights to just turn back on again. Mm-hmm. Because I found that idea really interesting of like, well, what happens afterwards? How do you deal with the choices that you made that you may not be proud of now that there isn't a disaster anymore? But in the end, I couldn't do that because I learned how electricity works. I had to get lovely author Elaine Webster's husband explained how electricity works to me with like pictures, and it was really, really helpful. And I realised it was not at all possible for the lights to just turn back on again.
See, we need that guy in a disaster, someone who understands electricity.
Yep, definitely.
And did that sort of bring it home to you that, oh, wow, I would be so vulnerable in this situation?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because when you're saying that, I'm like, I don't know how electricity works either. I turn on a light and it works.
Yeah. That's, yeah, it, yeah.
It's kind of terrifying me.
Yeah, I still don't really understand how it works, but I know it's a lot more complicated than I thought it was.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know. I feel like maybe we should brush up on these things just in case the lights do go out.
Yep.
Now, there's a belief that in disasters, and you see this a lot, that there are two ways that a community might respond. They might either come together to build a society or they'll turn against each other. Without giving anything away in your novel, I just thought this was really interesting to explore about the idea of community, because we can't even get it right when there's no disasters.
Yeah. I would hope that we would be more likely to get it right, I don't know, in a disaster. So one of the first things I did when I decided I wanted to write a book about preppers was I started to do research. And so I went off to see if anybody else had written books about preppers. And there's this one book called One Second After, that is like the prepper novel. It's like every prepper's favorite novel. It's also Newt Gingrich's favorite novel. And he like talked about it on the Senate floor in the US and wrote the introduction to it. And in this book, it's got a really similar premise. There's an EMP and all of the lights in a small town, all of the electricity in a small town go out. And the protagonist is a man who's, a sort of like a typical like American action hero who like used to be in military, but now he's like a university professor. So he's a little bit soft and nice as well as being sort of hard and tough. And I really hated the book. it was super masculine. It was full of, just these sort of really kind of gross depictions of women. Like every woman was sort of assessed on how bangable she was. And all of the men were just so aggressive. And within 3 days of this disaster happening, they are holding public executions in the town square. Like it just goes to like martial law and craziness so fast. And the book is littered with like them like, singing the national anthem and saying things like, I thought we were men. I thought we were Americans. And it just felt like such an aggressive, masculine view of how humanity works. When I wrote my book, it had to be mostly women and just sort of mostly women just, getting shit done.
Which is just like real life, right? But I do find that when you read these, end of the world disasters, that's what happens to men. All of a sudden, all the men become aggressive. Like if you read The Road or Handmaid's Tale and you think, wow, I don't know if that's preordained. I don't know if that's actually, true to men.
No, I don't think it is at all. And like it definitely does exist, and that's why there's the character of Rick in the book who definitely fits that mold. But then I wanted there just to be a lot of, very, very sensible women. And then there are a few men who are also kind and sensible and compassionate, like Peter Wu and like Keith. So I really wanted there to be like just a real mix of humans who responded differently and organically.
And that's what I liked about the novel too, because it was just about human beings. And we had people from a small town of all ages, different cultures, different education and intelligence. And in a disaster, like none of that matters anymore because you're all humans and you've just got that human need, for food and safety and shelter and community. So it sort of makes all those other things that we tend to worry about too much in our society disappear.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was something also that was really important to me, is to have these really, really different people, and some of them from very different backgrounds, sort of discover their common humanity.
I liked that. And I liked how you had a variety of characters as well. And with, you know, I don't like to give too much away, but it's hard when you're trying to have a conversation.
It is really hard.
But I think there was enough diversity in the characters to be representative of a wider society.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And that was something, yeah, that, as I said, was really important to me.
Mm. Now, with Prue and her sisters, I found that dynamic very interesting, you know, the sibling dynamic. Also the sister and the twins, I find that an interesting dynamic as well, because the twinning thing, they usually have this very strong relationship. And I was wondering how your characters develop for this family, because I imagine a challenge would be having three young protagonists who are female trying to make sure you separate each of those characters, which you did. But I'm wondering if that was a challenge for you and how you developed their characters.
Yeah, it definitely was a challenge, and sort of that was something that I definitely had to develop as I was writing. And I felt like I didn't really get much of a sense of Blythe, one of the twins, until sort of quite late in the piece, and sort of, and I really love Blythe. I really love her voice and her sort of rambunctiousness. Mm-hmm. So I was really happy to sort of figure out who she was. And I knew that I wanted to have, you know, like a big twin and a little twin sort of personality wise. And then originally actually they were supposed to be triplets, because I had read about how it was possible to be a twin and a triplet at the same time, that you can have like identical twins, which is like the egg that's split, but also a fraternal twin, which is another egg at the same time, sort of all at once.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and so you could have two identical twins and one non-identical. Triplets, two of whom are identical and one who isn't. And I was really interested in that idea. But in the end, it sort of just felt like an extra level of complication that I would have had to have explained really, really early on, and would have taken, you know, just a little bit of sciencey exposition that I don't think would have necessarily bought me anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I kind of like the idea of these twins who are really, really close, and then Prue, who is older and does kind of feel a little bit left out, because, you know, her sisters are so close that she sort of ends up being, you know, a surrogate mum sometimes or a third wheel.
I like that sibling, especially the sister dynamic as they're growing up, because it can be fraught with complexity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find siblings fascinating. I'm an only child, so being a twin is about as far away from my experience as it is possible to get. So it's something that's always really fascinated me.
Oh, I'm an only child as well, and I think that's why it fascinates me. And I hardly meet anyone who is an only child. It seems to be a rarity. It's lovely to speak to a fellow only child.
Mm.
I'd like to know about your writing process, because in many ways it was a thriller. There's also a lot of surprises and reveals in the novel, which I loved. And without talking about the ending, I want to know if this was planned from the beginning.
Mostly. Mm. I am a pretty strict planner. I always work to a very detailed plan. I usually start out with sort of a very rough idea of the shape of the story, and then from there go on to create like a full chapter by chapter plan before I start to write anything. So I did know how the story was going to end, and I knew exactly what the final motif, like the final couple of paragraphs of the story was going to be. And usually when I'm writing, I tend to write that very, very early. Like I like to write the very final moment long before I write the rest of the book, just because it helps me sort of get there.
Mm-hmm.
However, I was on a writing retreat with a bunch of other writer friends, just sort of finishing off the draft, and I realized that I had written the ending of the book and the conclusion, but I had sort of left out the climax. anyway, I'd realized that there wasn't a climax for the book, so I had to sort of, I brainstormed with some from very lovely people. Amy Kaufman was incredibly helpful, as she always is, Yeah, so I sorted it out and then had to sit down and write that final sort of climactic confrontation. But apart from that, everything was pretty much set in concrete.
Were there any times that you did surprise yourself? Because even though you're a writer who likes to plan, were there sometimes that you could surprise yourself and, you know, add something you hadn't thought of initially?
Definitely, always. Mm-hmm. Like, that's always the case. And, like, in every chapter you end up realizing that in order for the story to have the right shape, for the beats to land correctly, you'll need another scene or you'll need to take something out or a lot of that. And I did want initially the sort of, as I said, that for the lights to come on in the middle, but there was just so much story to tell of the disaster that ended up taking most of the book. And, of course, then I realized that the lights can't come back on. So that also complicated that factor. And so there was a lot of sort of back to the drawing board, but there were definitely like the really big emotional scenes in the book. They were always there from the beginning, particularly the midpoint, which is, I think, my favourite part of the book.
Yeah, I loved it. And, you know, you never know how a dystopian novel is or a story is going to end, because, you know, there's, I guess, at its very base, there's kind of two or three options. And I loved your ending. So for readers who haven't read the book, you need to get it. You need to get to the conclusion, because it's definitely worth the wait, I reckon.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. And also, after reading a book, I really have bunker envy. I've always wanted a bunker, and I feel like now's the time to start digging in my backyard.
Definitely. My parents have a holiday house down on the Great Ocean Road, and their next door neighbour has a bunker. It's more of like a fire shelter, like a bushfire shelter, and it's very, very modest. And when I saw it, I was like, oh, is that it? Oh, that's interesting. It doesn't have a gym or a shower or a library.
How are you going to survive in there for 20 years?
Yeah.
What's next for you? Do you have something else in the pipeline? Is there something, some other idea churning around?
Yeah, I do. I'll have another YA book out in August 2020, title to be announced once we figure out what it is.
Fair enough.
But it is another YA thriller, and it is about a girl who wakes up on a self-driving bus with no idea of who she is or how she got there, and there are seven other people on the bus and nobody has any memory.
Wow, terrifying, and probably not too far from our future.
Yeah. It was something that I thought would be really easy to write, and then it turns out it's really, really hard to write eight characters and nobody knows who they are. But it was like a really, really interesting challenge. And I also have a new picture book that will be out in October, which is called Clancy the Quokka, which is much more low stakes.
I was about to say, it doesn't sound as terrifying.
No, but, it's not at all terrifying.
Still sounds amazing. I love the idea of the quokka.
Yeah, it's super cute.
That's fantastic, because I think every kid needs to know what a quokka is.
Yeah.
And I look forward to the bus story. This is really intriguing me. And I just love that so much great young adult fiction's coming out. You know, I think when I was growing up, you had very limited things to read. You know, I was reading Judy Blume or whatever in my younger, early teenage years. But now there's just, teenagers are just such sport for choice. There's no excuse not to be reading something, because there are so many amazing novels out at the moment. What are you reading at the moment, or what have you read that's been amazing?
I'm currently reading Aurora Rising by Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff, which is, you know, about as exciting and fantastic and beautiful as you would expect a book by those two legends to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just read Highway Bodies by Alison Evans, which is a really amazing and terrifying queer zombie road trip thing of beauty and terror. Don't read it very late at night alone in the house, which is what I did. Claire Coleman's Terra Nullius, which is another really amazing sort of dystopian, mind-bending story that sort of blends history and other things in really fascinating and original ways. Oh, Shadow Sent by PM Freestone, which is a really, really beautiful debut book about a world where sort of magic and scent are linked together.
I'm about to start Mark Smith's Land of Fences, so I'm really excited about that. So another sort of dystopian end-of-the-world disaster book.
Yeah.
But it's been such a great series. I'm really looking forward to the third one.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Lily. I just really enjoyed your book. I loved it. I thought that the characters were wonderful. The story was so interesting. Even though you took a bit of creative license with the EMP, I had no idea. I thought it was great. I read that afterwards. But it was such a great book, and I think kids and young adults and adults are so lucky if they get their hands on it. So thank you so much for writing it.
Thank you so much for reading it.